So, welcome to the first of this year's public events with Professor Martin Amis, held by the Centre for New Writing. My name is David Alderson from the Department of English and American Studies here, and I'm also the co-director of the Centre for the Study of Sexuality and Culture, which I guess is why I've been asked to chair this opening session on literature and sex. But fortunately, it's a role which absolves me from having to express my own thoughts on the topic. So instead, let me introduce this evening's very sexy panel. Martin Amis is by now a familiar figure in Manchester, not merely through his formidable reputation, but as a result of having taken up the position of Professor of Creative Writing here in 2007. Sex as a preoccupation of his fiction was announced in his very first novel, The Rachel Papers, which dealt hilariously with the dual sexual and intellectual obsessions and ambitions of its teenage protagonist. Lots of sibilance coming through from this direction. I don't know if that's your impression. And sex is always inseparable in his fiction from the social personae of his characters, as it is, for instance, in the inversions of success in the book which carries that name. His forthcoming novel, The Pregnant Widow, explores the meanings and consequences of the sexual revolution of the 1960s, and from what I've been able to glean, promises a provocative engagement with feminism. Carol Maver is professor in the Department of Art History and Visual Studies here at the University of Manchester. She describes herself as an artist historian, as committed to performance as she is to scholarship, and whose scholarship itself she strikingly describes as performance too. Her major publications include Pleasures Taken, Performances of Sexuality and Loss in Victorian Photographs, Becoming, The Photographs of Clementina, Viscountess Howarden, and finally, and most recently, Reading Boyishly, Roland Barthes, J.M. Barrie, Jacques-Henri Lartigue, Marcel Proust, and D.W. Winnicott, an intriguingly eclectic list which indicates the breadth of her artistic, theoretical, and literary interests. Will Self's credentials for taking part in this event, and I'm not sure if he'll thank me for saying this, include a recent Bad Sex Award nomination from the Literary Review. Not the first, if I remember rightly. But such a nomination perhaps better illustrates what popular assumptions are held about what constitutes good sex in literature, which is, after all, often banally and predictably erotic or cringingly sentimental. These are adjectives that could never be hurled at Self, whose satiric and surreal writing explores philosophical, ethical, and political propositions and dilemmas even through sex, as in his collection of two novellas, Cock and Bull, which interrogates the relations between biological sex and gender through two characters who grow inappropriate sexual organs, or in his later novel, Dorian, An Imitation, which updates Wilde's original by focusing on the relations between Thatcherism, Blairism, gay subcultures, and the politics of all three, and all in relation to the AIDS pandemic. Will's more recent books include the collection of short stories, Liver, and a novel, The Butt, which I should explain in this context refers to a cigarette. I'm going to invite each of the speakers to talk in turn, and then we'll be opening up for discussion and debate. So, first of all, Martin, would you like to kick off?
Sure. Good evening, and thank you all very much for coming. And you can all hear me, I hope. I used to have a running argument with my father about sex in literature, and he said that it couldn't be done. Because for this reason, and I think it's the most powerful argument, he said the trouble with sex is it de-universalizes any character who indulges in it. That is to say, you can have a minor character with various foibles, but as soon as it's a central character, you begin to show your peculiarity. If heaven forbid you ever watch pornography, you'll notice that that you keep saying, "Oh no, don't do that." no, not yet. You know, Because your own quiddity, your own quirkiness is coming out. And this, he says, is disastrous in a work of literature. Now, I think we can narrow it down at the outset and say what you can't write about is good sex. This really is impossible. There are certain areas where literature can't go. Dreams is another one, although there are many brilliant exceptions. But Henry James was probably right when he said, tell a dream, lose a reader. I think you can tell a dream for a couple of sentences and then suddenly you're lost in this trail of again, peculiarity. You lose the broader picture. You can write about bad sex, and there's been a lot of good stuff about that. You know, the fiasco, getting entangled in your zip, you know, that sort of thing. But we'll come back to this. I'm just going to give us a surreal history of sex in Anglophone literature, with many gaps in it. But we accept that there was the sort of bawdy period of Chaucer, where certainly it was considered all right to have some filthy miller telling of his exploits. But at the same time, you have around them, tucked away in dialogue, you have the Gawain and the Green Knight, which has a very elaborate, very erotic, recurring scene of sexual temptation, which would have been, what, sort of 1300, 1400. Then you get Shakespeare and the sonnets, particularly, and the metaphysicals, and it may even be that this was a kind of peak for writing about sex for reasons that I'll come back to, but it seemed possible, particularly in Donne, to write about brainily about sex and love. Then something happened. And literary criticism calls it the dissociation of sensibility. And what happened, what supposedly happened, or arguably happened, was that the poet, the writer, was no longer able to think and feel at the same time. That sensibility became split. And although the Romantics made desperate attempts to regain this lost unity, it wasn't quite there for them. My father and Philip Larkin used to share a copy of Keats, who was perhaps with Byron's the most eroticized of the Romantics. And there's a line in Lamia, I think it is, or Edith St. Agnes, where this lover who's been stalking this mistress figure eventually gains access to her room, and the line goes, and into her dream he melted. And Larkin had written in the margin, there's lots of filthy annotations, are you mean he fucked it? But there were ways of writing about sex before it was all right to write about sex. Now, I'll give three brief examples. In Dickens, in Hard Times, Louisa Gradgrind is marrying the middle-aged Mr. Bounderby, I think it is, and she goes to see her father, Gradgrind, who's the utilitarian, the man without any imagination at all. And he said, I don't see what objection you have to marrying Mr. Bounderby, who's old and fat. And she said, have you seen those chimneys outside, father? He said, yes. And she said, at night, flames shoot out of them. And Gradgrind says, I don't see the relevance of that remark, Louisa. But you're still sort of wondering whether Dickens sees the relevance of it. And then there's the famous bit in Middlemarch where Dorothea, who's had what is plainly a mariage blanc with Casaubon, no question of there being of that marriage being consummated, goes to, I think it is Florence, This is when Will Ladislaw, who's, in terms of that novel, rather weakly romantic in that he's a bit too glamorous for such a middle ground novel as Middlemarch. And she is asked what she thinks of the paintings, and she says, "They frighten me." And that is definitely a way of talking about what a, by then, quite aging virgin would, how she would react to the sensuality of those paintings. My favorite example, and I don't think anyone's caught up with this yet, is Pride and Prejudice. Now, why do we so like the idea of Darcy and Elizabeth? A desire, we want them to get together, and it's a desire that survives many readings of the novel, but you're still slightly het up about whether it's going to happen. And also the inartistic feeling that I have that if the novel has a flaw, is that it's that we don't get a 30-page sex scene describing their marriage night. Now, the reason for this particular sort of keenness of our erotic and romantic interest, I think, is because they're made for each other. You know, she will loosen him up, he will have a sort of countervailing effect on her, but also sexually made for each other. And it's very interesting how this is done, because she is by far the sexiest of Jane Austen's heroines, and everyone senses this. And there are just two scenes that explain it, I think. The first is when she walks to Mr. Bingley's house because her sister Jane is ill. And we all know how these 19th century heroines can fall apart more or less overnight, you know, with the slightest chill. But she walks, her mother doesn't let her have the carriage because she hopes she'll get a cold like her sister and will have to stay there and might marry a rich man. But she does the walk herself, and I think it's 3 miles through open country, scandalizing Bingley's sisters. And she arrives with her petticoat 6 inches deep in mud and her face flushed and her very good teeth sparkling. And it's at that moment that Darcy falls for her. But petticoat in mud. Now, that this would mean nothing, perhaps, except if we link it with a later scene. Very near the end, where she tells her father that she wants to marry Darcy, and it's all fixed with Darcy, this event that we've been thirsting for throughout the novel. And he said, "I wouldn't dare refuse such a man," he said, "but I must advise you very powerfully, Lizzie, not to accept him. You would be neither happy nor respectable in a loveless marriage." He says, "I know your lively talents, Elizabeth, and in a loveless marriage, you would cease to be respectable." Now, what does that mean? There's nothing like it, remotely like it, in the whole of Jane Austen. And he's saying that unless it's a sexual marriage, you will stray. Very striking, I think. So we go on, and this great question in English literature, we see in Richardson, girls can't have sex unless they're drugged, basically. And Smollett is all about drugging girls. And Richardson, very excited by this idea, because it's the only way it can happen with a heroine, because she can't consent, and she can't enjoy it. So drugging them is the only way. Now, in the 19th century, it becomes established that certain women do fall. And this goes right through George Eliot with Maggie Tulliver and into Hardy. And then the real hinge figure or bridge figure is D.H. Lawrence. And by God, he got into a lot of trouble for it. And it wasn't just Lady Chatterley. Women in Love... he was summoned for libel. The Rainbow again summoned for obscenity, and the late Book of Poems, Pansies, discussed in cabinet and banned. And of course, they were watching him all the time anyway because he's married to a German woman. And I think Lawrence, you know, tremendously groundbreaking novelist, but never got anywhere with sex. And it, his sexual unions are more like fights than acts of copulation. And it soon becomes full of women hatred, and Mellers refers to Connie's pubis as her beak, and it all becomes tremendously antagonistic. But nonetheless, you know, as in the two famous lines, over famous lines, Larkin says, "Sexual intercourse began in 1963, which is a little late for me, between the end of the Chatterley ban and the Beatles' first LP." I think he got the date slightly wrong, actually. I think it was 66. There wasn't any sexual intercourse before then, but then it began. And now, you know, since then, you have the absolute freedom to write about sex, and I wonder how well it's been done. There's the, for instance, the Updike approach, where you send a kind of little Japanese film crew into the bedroom, and you write about sex with the exactness and sort of peeled eyeball attention to detail with which he writes about everything else. And it sort of makes me squirm a little bit. You get Nabokov, where I think he's consistently good on sex, but the great flower of this interest is Lolita, where the sex is in its nature slightly comic and very macabre, and I think that novel works out beautifully, and morally is a great novel, but it sort of shows that you have to come at it from a certain angle. Now, I learned something in my memory about why you can't write about sex. Very peculiar activity, sexual intercourse. Has two unique characteristics. It is indescribable, and it peoples the world. Now, there's a really do mark it out from all other fields of human activity. But once when I was writing a piece about escort girls, this was in the early 1970s. I went to an escort agency and found myself surrounded by big brochures of all the girls who were attractively photographed. And there were their vital statistics and other bits of information. And in just remembering that scene, I thought, that's the great corrupting thing, you see, that this is the brothel goer's mad power. That of choice. You know, Mick Jagger has a choice.
Not anymore.
You'd be surprised.
He just has money.
But the novelist has infinite choice. He can get things just how he wants them. And that's perhaps a fatally corrupting thing. Now I think it's all changing, and a further dissociation has happened in my lifetime. Not the dissociation of thought and emotion, but the dissociation of sex and feeling, where all the ancient colorations that affect sex because it is this elemental act that might lead to childbirth, all this, of course, ended in the 70s, a great draining of significance from sex is what we have lived through. And our children won't get their sex education by dissecting a worm or a few drunken words from your father. They'll get it from pornography. And I discovered writing about sex, I'm just finishing up, writing about sex in the novel I've just finished, that actually you can write about pornographic sex. Because there's no emotion and no significance in it. And what does that tell us about pornography? That it is the ancient human act drained of all significance. And suddenly you can write about it for that reason. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you very much. And can everyone hear me fine?
Yeah.
You're going to take the lights down a bit. I'm going to talk about circling sex, and since my time is so brief...
You have to explain this practice.
Of circling?
Circling sex.
I hope by the end it will be really clear.
Oh, circling around.
Circling around, yeah. Round and round and round, yeah. And since my time is so brief, I'm just going to focus on one letter, and that would have to be the letter O. Once upon a time, in the middle of winter, when snowflakes the size of feathers were falling from the sky, a queen was sitting and sewing by a window with an ebony frame. While she was sewing, she looked out at the snow and pricked her finger with a needle. 3 drops of blood fell onto the snow. The red looked so beautiful against the white snow. So begins Grimm's Snow White. And now we find this. Somewhere in the middle of Sod's Once Upon a Time, Philosophy in the Bedroom from 1795. Madame de Saint-Ange gives Eugénie a large needle containing a thick, red, waxed thread. Eugénie sews. What Eugénie sews are orifices. Both stories are about O's. The brothers Grimm take pleasure in opening it up, filling it, making it bleed. Sod takes pleasure in closing it and sewing it. Curiously, both the brothers Grimm and Sod generate a certain eroticism by being housed in a kind of domestic tranquility. Sex in the novel is about getting into letters. In the words of Samuel Richardson's Lovelace, the man of stitches and holes who sews his way through the epistolary Clarissa of 1748, "I shall never rest until I have discovered where the dear creature puts her letters." The letter O is derived from the Egyptian hieroglyph of the eye. The letter O is the roundness of the pupil, the roundness of the iris. An I is an O. I embrace the visuality and the sexuality of the letter O. But the O is not just I. The letter O is an open mouth for eating words, as in Jeremiah 15, verse 16. "When your words came, I ate them." That is sex. O is for Oralia, O-R-A-L-I-A, a golden mouthy word which I have stolen from Michael Moon. The large letter O opens the once upon a time of every fairy tale with great ornamental flurry. The big O is the letter as a decorously covered body, a place to go into and fill, a place to open and swallow, a place to peer into, a place to circle around, a place to be imprisoned endlessly, like a serpent biting its own tail, like Sod's writing, like Sod's own life, spent mostly in prison. Like a camera seeing, shooting, and eating its subject, an O is an eye, is a mouth. But the metonymic displacements hardly stop there. As is celebrated by Bataille's The Story of the Eye from 1928, a novel that Susan Sontag has school-marmishly claimed as the most accomplished artistically of all pornographic prose I have read. One hole feeds another. In Bataille's mouth, the eye becomes an endless series of orifices and orbs. Nipple, breast, egg, sun, bull's testicle. From beginning to end, the writing circles around sex. It is a vibration which, according to Roland Barthes, always produces the same sound. There is no conventional narrative. Everything and nothing happens. It is the O opened up by the Brothers Grimm and re-sewn by Saad over and over again. The story of the eye is all sex, always producing the same sound. The circularity of the story of the eye is boring. Adam Phillips describes boredom as desire for desire. The most interesting sex in literature might be best described as boring. Here I am thinking of a range of texts, my favorite boring novels, from Bataille's Story of the Eye, Official Pornography, to Samuel Richardson's nine-volume, 969,000-word Clarissa. I miss Lovelace's deflowering of Clarissa on the first read. To Marcel Proust's seven-volume, really, really, really long, In Search of Lost Time, in which the narrator is fond of sexing sleeping Albertine with such incredible subtlety, one has to work really hard to find it. Eve Kaskowski Sedgwick writes about having sex. She says, "Some people like spontaneous sexual scenes. Others like highly scripted ones. Others like spontaneous sounding ones that are nonetheless predictable." End of quote. One thing has to be said about sex in literature. It is highly scripted, even when the story is one of spontaneous sex. Bataille, Richardson, Proust, they are writers of highly crafted sexual boredom. Good boredom. It creates desire in me, the reader. They circle sex.
Well, I do think that Proust becomes a lot sexier when you realize that Albertine was in fact Marcel's Belgian chauffeur, Albert. I was very interested to hear what Carol had to say, and very interested to hear what Martin had to say, but I don't feel that I can entirely concur with either of them, both for practical reasons, because we'd then have nothing to talk about, but also for rather more genuine ones. I think it is possible, contentiously, I'm going to suggest that it is possible to write well about good sex, and indeed that it's done quite a lot. And so that's part of my argument. That being said, I broadly accept Martin's schema, and in particular, I accept the notion of, which he defined in his own very articulate way, of what J.G. Ballard called the death of affect, the kind of enormous loss of feeling that seems to have occurred since the 1960s and is evident in a lot of the ways that we write about sex. But what occurred to me listening to both of them were several things. It was, you know, the line from the Song of Solomon, "Thy belly is like unto a heap of wheat," which is dead sexy and gets repeated actually in the John Cheever story, The Swimmer, and then is memorably put into the mouth of Burt Lancaster in the film adaptation as he croons over the golden belly of the nubile daughter of one of his swimming pool-owning neighbours. And what made me think about this was biblical sex, sex in the Bible. Sex, desire, eroticism. It's always been possible to write pornography, and in a sense the bawdy was the pornography of its time. It's never been a problem. But the erotic is metaphoric. The erotic is always about something other than cocks and cunts. When you get down to cocks and cunts, you're no longer with the metaphor, you're with the meta-friend, and there's nowhere really to go with that but to put it in there or stick it up there or do this with it or do that with it. And what our culture faces as a problem in writing about sex is that it's become permissible to write entirely about the meta-friend. And the interesting writing to be done about sex was really exactly at the point where the metaphor and the meta-friend started to untangle themselves gummily from each other. So we do face a bit of a crisis when it comes to writing about sex, because pornography is allowable in a mainstream literary discourse. It becomes extremely difficult to avoid it. It becomes extremely difficult to avoid a naming of parts. And indeed, you're in danger as a writer about sex of looking recherché if you attempt to do it without that kind of degree of technicality. I mean, most of us in this room, and you know, I heard what Martin said about his father and Philip Larkin's annotated copy of Keats, and I thought his remarks on Elizabeth Bennet were very, very telling. And I have to say, I often think of that scene in Pride and Prejudice, and I often think how much I would like to live in a society where if you had a mild head cold, you'd be allowed to stay for 3 weeks. I mean, I've got a mild head cold at the moment, and I had to come from Ilkley this morning. I do think it's possible to write about good sex, but I think it becomes very corrupting, this business of the naming of parts. And I think one of the problems that writers face when they come to write about good sex is, of course, their own desire and the projection of their own desire. And how that, and I think Martin nailed that as well, but how that kind of, you know, the Mick Jagger superego of choice, how it expresses itself both in female and male writers, I don't think there's any distinction here, is in a kind of ghastly saccharine quality that you get in sex scenes that are meant to be satisfying and, you know, full of what Freud would have termed full genitality. This from a man who, according to his most reliable biographers, didn't have sex at all after he was about 45. Maybe that's the way it should be for all of us. that we know of. I think you see it in the writing of, in so many writers, you see it, you see this. It comes off the page like a great whiff of semen or vaginal mucus sort of burning into you, this idea that somebody is actually getting their jollies off writing this stuff, and it's extremely off-putting. And I'm not going to name chapter and verse because it would be invidious, but you're welcome to see me afterwards and I can give you some prime examples of the criminals in this particular literary field. Some of the things that I think that were missed out, this business of writing about deferred sex, about writing about eroticization. I mean, in a sense, there are some writers who jumped the gun and did it rather elegantly. One thinks particularly of Bloom's masturbation scene in Ulysses, which, you know, was way out there ahead of the field in top quality literary wank scenes, and well worth wading through the rest of the book for. And indeed, of course, Molly Bloom's internal monologue at the end, which, while not in a sense explicitly sexual, is all about sex and all about being a sexual being, and is a really astonishing piece of writing. And a really, but I think that the text that stands, if you like, as the gatekeeper between the time when it was possible to write about sex and the time when it stopped being possible in certain kind of key ways is Lolita, because Lolita is all about bringing all of these things together. It's about teasing the metaphor and the meta-friend, titivating them apart from one another. It's about manipulating the reader, and it's about manipulating the reader's own desire for good literary sex. It's a self-consciously highly literary novel. There is no... Amazing to think that it sold 100,000 copies in its first 12 weeks. Imagine a book... If Nabokov published it now in this country, he'd be damned not for the pedophile sex, but for the ludicrous sesquipedalianism of his vocabulary. People would say, "Oh, he must write with a dictionary next to him." we can get on to that. I had thought of reading you one of my sex scenes. I felt that an evening like this would not be complete without a description of a British general practitioner having sex with a man who has a vagina in the back of his knee. In fact, I don't really feel any gathering nowadays is complete without such a reading, but very, very sadly, the excellent bookstore that came along didn't have a copy of the book within which this scene occurs. And so I don't think I'm going to do that. I'm just going to gracefully and gratefully slide, a little moistly, out of the encumbrance of this discourse and re-enter it, fired up anew, shortly.
Thank you, all three of you. I wanted to start off with a question which, in fact, was Martin's first point. About the universality and the de-universalising feature of sex in literature. I just wondered why we feel it's necessary that literature should be universalising in that way, and why sex should contribute towards such a phenomenon, and how could it do that, possibly?
Well, I think that's what the novel is an attempt at universality. In contradistinction to poetry, I wish I knew this off by heart, but I don't quite. But we think of Auden's poem, Auden's sonnet, The Novelist, where he begins by saying, "Encased in talent, like a uniform, the poet, you know, has all these characteristics. He dies young. Poets can dash forward like hussars." They amaze everyone. But then he comes to the novelist and says, theirs is a different kind of endeavor, that they have to be every man, with the boring, boring with the boring, with the filthy, filthy too, and in their own person as best they can, absorb all the wrongs of man. It's very approximate. The poet isn't universal. That's why we love poets. They're impenetrably just themselves. Whereas the novelist, being dependent not on inspiration in the sense of a flatus, but being dependent on the grindstone. Novelists are grinders. They have to be. These pieces of prose that take them 5-6 years to write, it's a different kind of approach. And you know, despite the million ways of doing it, the million directions of coming at it, there is some spirit level that they all aspire to. And this is always completely upset by sex. And I think we're all according Lolita a kind of central role or a central place. But it did skew the late Nabokov. The last decade of his life is sort of... You know, he wrote a novel in the 30s in Berlin called The Enchanter,
which is the prototype of Lolita. Same plot, marrying the mother, drugging the girl. And it ends very crudely with a horribly described near sexual violation of the drugged, insufficiently drugged girl. And then she screams very sort of terrifyingly at him. And he runs out of the hotel and throws himself under a tram. Now, in Lolita, the sexual comeuppance is much more, infinitely more complicated, and I think perfect. But then after that, you get Lolita, I mean, you get Ada, which has a terrible sort of romp feeling about it. Whereas in Lolita, the molestation of the two-year rape, nightly rape of a 12-year-old, then a 13-year-old, is considered to be a crime that he actually does specifically compare to the Holocaust. In Ada, it's just taken as a kind of, you know, something you can do if you're upper class. As Updike said of it, you know, rape is the sexual vice of the proletariat. Adultery, that of the bourgeoisie, and incest, that of the upper classes. So you get several hundred pages of Ada or about sex with 12-year-olds, sex with 14-year-olds, having sex with a 14-year-old and a 10-year-old. And there's this fantasy about these world chain of brothels where there are 10-year-old girls. Then you get the beautiful little novella, Transparent Things, which is quite disfigured by a scene where he's looking at photographs of the girl he hopes is his future wife, and sees her as a baby, and as a 10-year-old, 6-year-old, and much more specific descriptions than you would like of her sexual powers. And he actually gets an erection, and he stacks up the album so his future mother-in-law can't see this effect that's having on him. Of course, he never uses sexual words. He says, his retractile heart moodily withdrew. Then you get the last novel, Look at the Harlequins, which again has a man with a 12-year-old daughter, and they go around the house naked. There's not much about it. And now we have this fragment that's been published, the original of Laura Ware. There's someone called Hubert, who takes liberties with a 10-year-old girl. And this gives Nabokov's, you know, passionate admirers a problem from hell, really. Because you can always say of Lolita, there is no character issue. There is nothing that resembles a victim in any of this. You know, except Lolita herself as a fictional character. But it seems to have, you know, rocked him on his plinth, and a great splurge of incontinence on this subject. I think it's...
You are what you eat.
Yeah. And it's a destabilizing and deuniversalizing force. As anyone knows, you know, people who have it on the brain can only see things in sexual terms. It's tremendously... It leeches out color from everything around it.
I think you're being a little bit unfair on Blair. I mean, I think that's exactly what happened. I mean, I do know that... I mean, I'm a great believer in the mutability of human sexuality. I mean, I think, you know, most of us, if we were in jail, would do that. And if we don't already, and that's... Cool, and I know that when... So, I mean, I think there's very few people whose sexuality isn't mutable in some way. I know that when I was writing Dorian, which is a gay novel, and I'm ostensibly a straight man, I became very gay. And very happily gay. And started, you know, dreaming, having erotic homosexual dreams, started fancying men. And in order to justify this, in fact, if you're really on a rainy Thursday afternoon, you can go and look this up online, wrote a number of pieces in which I argued quite strenuously that everybody really, really was gay, and that we were soon going to be in a kind of post, you know, gender-based sexuality world. And I sort of came round from this madness about 6 months after I'd finished the book, and clearly Vlad just didn't kind of get down.
So you cottaged for a couple of months.
I didn't actually cottage. No, just didn't have the energy for the whole what Father Ted memorably called the whole rough and tumble of the gay lifestyle. But I certainly was kind of up for it. I mean, somebody brought the cottage to me.
So from this it follows that...
Well, I just sort of think... I think it's sort of coming back, really, to the point I made before, and I think you open up this idea of choice, and you open up this idea of, you know, one of the problematic modalities of writing about sex is to kind of keep yourself out of the equation. Vlad's problem was that he inadvertently allowed himself into the equation. Something happened. I think it was always said, I mean, you're the great Nabokovian. I think it was said that he had to research quite thoroughly into paedophiles in order to convincingly build...
Did he research 12-year-old girls?
Right, well...
Not the same thing. Do you see Lolita as being a sort of pivotal...
I do. What I think, to get back to your question about the universalizing, I think that's why we find Lolita so disturbing, is in fact we do understand Humbert's desire, that in fact that's the success of the novel, that we see it through his eyes. I think you can almost start rooting for him when you're reading it, and you feel, then you suddenly get a hold of yourself, what am I thinking? And I, that's where it becomes pornographic, I guess. But interestingly enough, I mean, the way we're talking about sexuality and describing sex, and everyone seems to be saying that there's, you know, this possibility of writing sex in Lolita, I think, you know, the first time he ejaculates is not the sexiest part of the novel. I think it's when he looks at her class list and talks about those names in alphabetical order, and it's a poem, forsooth, you know, and he gets very hot about seeing this list of names in alphabetical order. So I think it's important to talk about the fact that there's a lot of good sex in novels that isn't just, you know, conventional.
I don't think there's anything.
Isn't there a risk of being slightly decorous about sex in this discussion? I mean,
I'm not being decorous.
But it sounds like that somehow pornography ruined everything, and that we must draw neat distinctions between.
I talked a lot about pornography.
Pornography is dull. I mean, there's nothing. Pornography just is dull. I mean, you know, Fanny Hill is dull. The story of O is dull. I mean, it puts you in mind of Bob Dylan.
I don't like the story, though. I mean, I guess that's how you...
Oh, it's fucking dumb.
I think Fanny Hill is dumb. I don't think the story of the eye is dumb. I don't think it's dumb. But I don't think... I was trying to say, I think that there's something really interesting in that kind of boredom, too. And I was quite serious about it.
Take your point. I don't actually...
And I love Albertine. I think she's great and sexy and interesting and... It's the way it's so played out. It's a whole long story of inversion. She may be based on his chauffeur, but everyone in the novel turns out to be gay by the end, save for the narrator who himself is gay. I mean, it's that twisting and that slowness of it that I think is so erotic and so sexual.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're twisting the idea of boredom there a little bit. I would take issue with you over.
Well, maybe it's what happens to me when I'm in that boring space as well.
I don't think the story of the eye is boring, but I don't really think it's pornography, I have to say. Just doesn't. It's never struck me as pornography. I think Bataille was one of those French men who, you know, quite addicted to prostitutes, quite keen of his image as a decadent, quite intent on it. He wrote that book Erotism, you know, absolutely kind of obsessed by it. But rather over-egging it. It puts me in mind. I remember being on Apostrophe with Michel Houellebecq, and there were all these critics around talking about his novel Platform, and, you know, absolutely getting incredibly steamed up about Platform. All these kind of a gaggle of septuagenarian French literary critics who quite clearly hadn't had a shag in years. And Welbeck said to me afterwards, what did you think about that? And I said, you know, they just kept on talking about this because they're not getting enough sex. You know,
that's what Foucault says. That's why we're all here. It's the repressive hypothesis, but I didn't want to admit it.
On that point, I'll open up to questions. Who'd like to kick us off? Over here, down at the front. Do you want to wait for the microphone to arrive?
A very phallic microphone, instead.
Yes, it's why a lot of people are intimidated by them. I enjoyed, by the way, Wilsoff's, your interpretation of Dorian, and I thought it was very interesting how you encapsulated the total hedonism of the 80s when it clearly was set. And I thought suddenly it was a book that could be rewritten every 50 or so years. So whether it will, I don't know.
It's my novel, Dorian.
Dorian, yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know what, of course, Joyce said about... Joyce wrote a monograph on Wilde's Dorian Gray in 1922, and Joyce said that, you know, he liked the picture of Dorian Gray a lot, except that Wilde had lacked the courage of his own invert convictions, and that the novel should have been explicitly homosexual, because of course it is a gay novel. Wilde's original is a gay novel. There's nothing remotely believable about the femaleness of the female love object in it. So I was really only following up on that. I'm not sure whether it can in a way be rewritten, because I think what is fascinating about gay sexuality and the particular history of writing about gay sexuality is that in a way what Wilde understood was that the gay subculture of London in the 1890s was the avant-garde of human sexuality. That was the way that everybody was going to go. He kind of got it. We were all going to end up as dilly boys and girls. So, you know, I think that's really what I was trying to express in the book.
Hi there. First of all, thanks for such an interesting talk. And I wanted to ask, firstly, about those prime examples of literary criminals writing bad sex, who you think they are. And also, secondly, whether you think there's any parallel to be drawn between the creative act of writing a novel and having sex. I mean, some writers have spoken about the erotic nature of writing itself, and I wondered if you had any thoughts about that.
Actually, this is something I remember Will wrote, where he says, he said, no, it's very solitary, and when you have your office party at the end of the year, you get drunk by yourself and then you have a wank behind the Xerox. Well, I mean, this brings up the huge question of the connection between the creative and the erotic. They are inextricable. And also, it's horrifyingly onanistic in that it's just you. And the definition of a novelist, even more than a poet, is someone who is most alive when alone. So that is an unavoidable connection.
Well, I guess just generally, the whole construction, I mean, someone like a theorist like Teresa de Loretos says that desire itself is a kind of narrative, and so, you know, we're all sort of writing and trying to, she says, well, she masculinizes it, this masculine figure is trying to move through this feminized space, you know, as a sort of acidic environment around it, you know, it sounds like sperm going after the egg, and, you know, it's may the best man win, and you have a kind of climax, and that's the way narrative tends to work. And even when we try to write anti-narrative or narrative with a vengeance, we still have that structure of that kind of sexual climax in mind. I think that's quite interesting to think about.
the three-act problem, in other words, is sexual. Hmm. I don't see many pre-epic hands out there.
Oh! I just wonder if Sebastian Fox is one end of the scope. If someone like Pierre Guillotin, who masturbates while he writes, would be at the other?
I don't know who Pierre Guillotin is. He's not staying at my house.
Certainly not at your desk.
I think the problem, one of the problems is, I mean, a writer who I think is interesting and of course wrote a lot explicitly about sex would be William Burroughs, but I think there's a problem with, you know, writing about sex that in a sense one doesn't identify with. And, you know, it makes me think of Dylan's line in Highway 61 Revisited about Burroughs, you know, "I wish I could give Brother Bill his big thrill. I would put him in chains at the top of a hill and send out for some boys and Cecil B. DeMille. He could die happily ever after." And you sort of think, yeah, I really don't want to die with you. But I strongly resist the equation between literary composition and the erotic. There's absolutely nothing sexy about it at all. Do you think there is, Bud? You're looking a bit furtive.
I think that there are moments when it is like that. When a difficulty resolves itself, when there is a sort of using disgusting word like fusion. It's never when writing is sexy. I mean that is if you find yourself getting excited when you're about to write a sex scene, then you should have a cold shower. In fact, you know you're you're following a false lead entirely. I mean, it is marvelous and marvelously funny and marvelously transparent when you see a novelist trying to build themselves up in this way, satirized by Kurt Vonnegut, who has one of his characters typing out a sex scene. It goes, "She let out a groan, half pleasure, half pain, brackets, how do you figure a woman? As I rammed the old Avenger home." And there's a very minor novelist called John Brain who wrote a famous book called Room at the Top and later a TV series called Life at the Top. And one of his last novels begins, "My mistress propped herself up on the pillow, covered her enormous and shapely breasts with the sheet and said, 'It's just not fair.' She said, 'Look at you. You're a world-famous novelist. You have the body of a young boy. Also the energy. I mean, you're just amazing. I mean, the way you can go on all night.'" She goes on like this for pages and says, "Thanks, Lou." I mean, when the novelist can't... This is a male sin, in my view. I think it is really very different with female writers. I think the old line about how do you distinguish between real sincerity and literary sincerity, it was said that when you hear about the death of a friend, you can burst into tears, but you can't burst into song. I've always thought, and would stand by this, that there is a little more song in women's writing, inimical to some male writers. And Nabokov said he was exclusively homosexual in his literary tastes.
Well, I think, yes, but that's a function of the metafriend. I mean, you know, men are equipped with a dangling metafriend that you've got to do something with. It's very difficult to euphemize. And I think that the actual kind of geometry, I think this is a physiological problem, the actual sort of geometry of desire is different for women. And I think that...
Women don't need to stress their strength as men.
They don't need to stress their strength. But, you know, there is, women writers can be as guilty of the crime of choice. They can be as guilty of pornographic writing in all its dull variations. I mean, there is no... This is really not about... you know, it's not a gender-based issue at all in that way, I don't think.
Well, I think that the experience is gender-based, all right. I mean, I don't think it's an equivalent experience. I mean, that is an old equalitarian argument from 30 years ago. And if it's different, and it must be, then there must be different ways of writing about it. Who are these girls who write?
Can we take
a
girl?
To be more female than male.
How many people are writing about bad sex?
Yeah. And if so,
I imagine almost everybody here would shortly be leaving to start up.
A couple of parents.
They're very difficult to produce a reliable statistic. But I did actually look it up before I left my hotel room. And of all writers, 67% about bad sex, and of those, 57% are men and 43% women. It tends to bear out Martin's argument.
I'd say it's nearly all bad sex. I mean, all comic fiction is about bad sex.
Mm.
You know, that whole genre, there's not a good session in the whole corpus.
But you have to be responsive to the demands of naturalism to some degree, and you have to ask yourself, I mean, I think a guy from the Manchester Evening News called me up to interview me for this session, and he said, you know, you've been nominated for this Bad Sex Award, and I said, yeah, I've never really understood the parameters of this award. Is it that I write badly about sex, or is it that I write about bad sex? You know, what's going on?
The floor.
I really needed to come all the way from Elkley to hear that.
My wife is nominated too.
Okay. Two people waiting to ask questions down here. Can we take the one at the end there first and then we'll come back here?
Can you tell me, please, whether you think that there's anything that you shouldn't be allowed to write about in relation to sex in literature? For example, is there something that you feel should be censored, given the fact that at the time when Caroline Duffy's poem in relation to knife, allegedly about knife crime, was censored, we're talking about Lolita and the book and how good it is, given the fact that at the moment there's a social fear and outcry around paedophilia, do you think there's anything in relation to writing about sex that you shouldn't be able to write about?
Well, I think the definition of sex is, the definition of writing is that writing is freedom, and there are no entry signs or speed limit signs of any kind. You have to be guarded by, you know, what you feel you can do, and every writer after a few years realizes that there are certain things, certain acts of brutality and mercilessness that they cannot understand. And I'm quite happy to give up areas that I don't understand. And I'm reminded what Primo Levi said about the Holocaust. When he said, do you understand what made the Holocaust come about? What made Nazism pursue the Holocaust? And he said, no, I don't understand it. And I think there's a duty not to understand it. He said, because when you understand something, you contain it. You include it within yourself. And there are certain acts, I think, that are so anti-human.
Interesting.
That I'm quite happy to count myself as someone who doesn't understand. And that, obviously, you can't go near it as a writer if you feel like that. Certain areas.
I think he was in denial. I think he understood it only too well. And that's exactly what If This Is A Man is about. It's about understanding the Holocaust. He did understand it, and when his denial didn't shore up, his survivor guilt killed him. You know, it was very interesting you should say that, because Günter Grass was on the radio the other day saying exactly the same thing, and I think it's a canard. He was saying, I can't understand, you know, I was compelled into the Waffen-SS as a child, and I don't understand how civilized people like the Germans could have perpetrated the Holocaust. I understand how civilized people like the Germans perpetrated the Holocaust. Well, I understand how, you know, how the genocide in Rwanda happened. I understand how all these things happen because humans are vicious, merciless, aggressive animals under certain circumstances and act collectively. And if you don't know that and you're grown up, then, you know, you shouldn't really get out of bed in the morning.
It is slightly different when it's in the heart of a civilized country, I think, and you bring industrialized killing methods to bear. I think that does distinguish it from Rwanda. And I bear in mind what Nabokov says about it in Pnin. He says he's remembering an old love who died in the Holocaust, and he says. Only in the kind of lucidity that would precede death do you dare understand how people could take that girl with that frown, that smile, and fill her full of broken glass, or burn her, or inject her with typhus. You shouldn't have an understanding of that in your waking life. Only in the most extreme moment would you be able to understand that. I don't pretend. I don't say with a shrug. Human beings are animals. We all know that it's there.
I wrote a story. It's called what is it called? It's called The Nonce Prize. It's about a pedo. It hinges on a man being framed for a paedophile killing, and it was quite difficult to write. And it does contain at least one scene that is very disturbing. And I found disturbing to write. But I didn't for a second feel myself self-censoring. I'm only saying that to not get hung up on the Holocaust thing, which I profoundly disagree with you about, and later on we're going to nude mud wrestle.
Just to get back to your comment about what people should be allowed to do, I don't know what the laws... I know the laws in the States, I don't know the laws in Britain, but that's what distinguishes pornography, which is legal... from obscenity, often can be, if it's deemed to have artistic value, which is really interesting, I think. So that makes it quite complicated.
It's the same criterion here.
Literary critics have been trying to establish how you establish literary merit, and then you say you've got absolutely nowhere with it.
That's right. But they will, I have been asked to come... to write for court cases for, drawings or photographs that people have been caught carrying around, coming from Britain into the States. And it's a very odd thing, because I don't believe that things should be censored either, but at the same time, I don't necessarily think these things should be around.
I think the interesting thing about literature, which, of course, distinguishes it from the visual arts, is that it's not immediately apprehensible. There is nothing about a book that forces itself on a reader. A reader has to step towards a book, and step quite a long way towards a book. I mean, if you open a book and there is a disturbing or depraved or obscene scene, it's not going to pull you in like in that kind of Chris Morris spoof where the pedos gain control of the computer and sort of lure kids into it. It can't do that, a book. So, in a sense, one of the great virtues of the novel as an art form is its inaccessibility in that way. It's not pressing any images on people. You have to cooperate with it. The thing about Caroline Duffy's poem was that this was something that was on a syllabus in a school, and if you're on a school syllabus, you go, coming to you, Caroline. Yeah, but that's not the point. There's a modishness about these things, isn't there?
Did you want to come back?
Yeah. It's always interesting. I've heard so many discussions about.
Can you just wait until the microphone?
Over the years, I've heard so many discussions about sex, and it doesn't take long. And it took probably a matter of seconds before paedophilia reared its head up as an issue. Isn't it easier, isn't it easy to justify paedophilia through very nice writing and somehow, as part of a process of desensitizing people to the subject Is there not a responsibility from writers to sort of, I wouldn't self-censor, you know, I hate to say that, but, you know, otherwise they could be accused of desensitizing people to very emotive issues.
But how could you say that Lolita desensitizes, for example, the reader? I think it's just the opposite.
Can I take the question over there, and perhaps in conjunction with the one we just had?
Thank you. I was just moved to join the debate because of the direction it's going in terms of censorship. I thought it was interesting that Martin Amis started this discussion and brought up the subject of Lady Chatterley as being the start of sex in Great Britain, of course, when the ban on that novel was lifted. I think it's very dangerous for anybody, critic, reader or author, to impose censorship on any form of art. It's down to the individual who responds to that piece of art to make a moral judgment for themselves in response to that. And I'm drawn to think of Last Exit to Brooklyn, which of course was censored for many years and is now recognised as one of the, you know, groundbreaking pieces of literature in terms of how we understand homophobia and also misogyny, and how sexual violence can be used to suppress people and to, in some cases, murder them because we don't like their sexuality or we don't like the way they comport themselves. And I personally am very, very disturbed to hear people in this audience talk about censorship in terms of literature when it comes to sexuality in any form. Thank you.
Why don't you mute Mud Wrestle to decide who's right afterwards? But you think you're getting a little bit overexcited about this. The problem with our society is not any censorship. It really isn't. You can say anything you like in this culture. The only problem is that nobody's listening anymore because they're reading some blog by Gary down the pub about a terrific wank he had last night. I mean, you know, we live in a society that is stunned into inertia by the plethora of available transgressive art forms that they have. Think back. You know, sod Hubert Selby in Last Exit to Brooklyn. Joyce couldn't get Dubliners published for 12 years because it had a mildly cheeky remark about the then Prince of Wales in it, but she wouldn't compromise. I mean, that, you know, you need to think carefully about what censorship really was like before you kind of go off, you know, worried about, you know, the dead hand of censorship being imposed upon us now, because it just isn't true. There isn't. Don't you think?
Well, maybe I don't think it's true, and it certainly hasn't been mentioned at night.
No, I don't think that's the issue. I mean, our problem is that any hotel room in this country, commercial hotel room you check into, you can see an erect penis with the veins standing out on it being rammed into a vagina within seconds of sort of putting your key card in the door. That is our problem as a society. And you don't need to be kind of buffed and tuffed and or Casibon to feel that way about it at all, do you?
Ha! I'll take one final question over here. Excuse me, can you just wait till
the... Yeah, wait for the microphone. Everybody's going off early.
Given that's the case, and we've talked earlier this evening about the disassociation between sex and feeling, then where do we go from here? I mean, is there anything more to write about, given that we can see these things when we go back to our hotel rooms? It's all out there. You know, pornography has now replaced sex in a way, in terms of, you know, our discourse on sexuality. I mean, where does the novel go? Is there anything left to say?
What about voice? I mean, I was thinking about that when you brought up William Burroughs, that we talk about the form of the novel or the narrative, but I think it's the voice that makes it erotic or makes it sexual. And I was thinking, even the difference, I'm not sure what to do with this, after hearing William Burroughs speak and then meeting his writing, and then how that has a certain kind of effect.
I think you write about, you know, it comes back to the question about the universalizable thing. I mean, it always strikes me the interesting thing about novels is that they're, you know, it's not without accident that the slang term for the instructions for an appliance is the book of words. You know, and novels are the kind of books of words. And, you know, they are instructions in a way. They're instructions about how to do all sorts of things and to feel all sorts of things and to think about all sorts of things. And the answer is we just go on. We keep on keeping on. And we write about the state of affairs as we find it. And, you know, I think Ballard is very notable in this because he understood this death of affect very early on. And he wrote about it at great length. And he wrote always about sex as an analogue in one way, or he saw its analogue within the wider society, and he wrote brilliantly about it. He also, incidentally, wrote very tenderly about sex in a very, very unusual way in some of his more autobiographical work. So, you know, I think it can be done, it will be done, and we will keep on doing it. I don't think there's any crisis here, actually. I think it's business as usual.
Well, I think that... someone of my age, my sex life, unimaginable by the earlier generation, and the sex lives of my children, unimaginable by me, and the sex lives of their children. I mean, I think, as is the acceleration of history we're seeing in the sexual sphere too, and I've no idea where it's going to end up, but they're going to be very different people for this reason. Perhaps we close on, I found writing about the sexual revolution, the best thing ever written about it was Shakespeare. And by Father, in these the first few lines are very famous, the next ones are not so famous. Father, take it to mean the previous generation. Full fathom five thy father lies, of his bones a coral made, those are pearls that were his eyes. Nothing of him doth fade, but doth suffer a sea change into something rich and strange. Sea nymphs hourly ring his knell.
Thank you very much.